We come to trust these AI tools, these AI companies, but what happens to the data? What happens when the company goes away and you don't have that tool, or they do just get acquired and they just shut down and sunset the product? So I think, again, it's just a bit of a cautionary tale of this is a very dynamic space we're living through, and it's just starting.
Welcome to the Artificial Intelligence Show, the podcast that helps your business grow smarter by making AI approachable and actionable. My name is Paul Raitzer. I'm the founder and CEO of Marketing AI Institute, and I'm your host. Each week, I'm joined by my co-host and Marketing AI Institute Chief Content Officer, Mike DePut, as we break down all the AI news that matters and give you insights and perspectives that you can use to advance your company and your career. Join us as we accelerate AI literacy for all.
Welcome to episode 89 of the Artificial Intelligence Show. I'm your host, Paul Raitzer, along with my co-host, Mike Put. We are both in Cleveland this week, right?
We're back in Cleveland.
We are in Cleveland. We're recording this one a little early. It is Friday, March 22nd at 1 p.m. Eastern time. We usually record on Monday mornings, but I've got a talk Monday. It was going to eat up most of my day. So we're doing this on Friday, but it worked out well, because it was a really busy week in terms of like large language models and lots of news to cover in that. We've got an interview with Sam Altman. We've got some changes at Inflection and Microsoft, a bunch of stuff from Google. So it just really worked out where we had plenty to go on by Friday. So it was okay to cut it a day short or an afternoon short. So hopefully nothing crazy happens Friday afternoon or Monday morning. But like I said, we've got plenty to get through already. So this episode is brought to us by the Marketing AI Conference, or MAKON. It'll be September 10th to the 12th this year. This is our fifth annual MAKON, so it's hosted by Marketing AI Institute. MAKON was created back in 2019 for marketing leaders and practitioners seeking to drive the next frontier of digital marketing transformation within their organizations and in their own careers. At MAKON, you'll learn from top AI and marketing experts while connecting with a passionate and motivated community of forward-thinking professionals. The 2023 event drew more than 700 people to Cleveland, Ohio, the convention center in Cleveland, right across from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And we're expecting probably 1,500 or more this year. Is kind of we're trending above, but that's the goal was 1,500, and right now it's looking pretty good. And inside track, we will actually, if all goes well, be announcing the vast majority of the agenda probably sometime in the next 10 to so days. I don't know. I don't want to put Tracy on the spot, but I've personally spent the last 3 days this week going through over 150 submissions for speakers, in addition to my own sandbox of about 50 more speakers. And we are at the point where we're going to be able to announce the vast majority of the speakers. The main stage, we won't announce all those. There's some stuff in the works there, but we are going to announce a good portion of the speakers. So stay tuned for that. You can learn more at MAKON.AI. That's MAICON.AI. And again, that's coming up September 10th to the 12th in Cleveland, Ohio. We would love to have you be a part of it and join Mike and I and the rest of the Institute team there. Okay, Mike, I know you and I both listened to the Lex Fridman interview with Sam Altman, so that seems like a pretty good place to start.
All right. So Sam Altman, like you mentioned, just gave another in-depth interview, and this time it was on the Lex Fridman podcast, and they covered everything from the OpenAI board saga back when Sam got briefly fired, to Elon Musk's more current lawsuit, to GPT-5. Now, this interview clocks in at nearly 2 hours long, and it contains some very interesting comments from Altman that we think are worth unpacking. So, Paul, what jumped out to you most during the interview?
It's honestly like hard to narrow this down. If you look at the timestamps of the interview, I would definitely recommend people go listen to it. I think that it's just so important. You know, I've said it many times in the show. One of the ways I learn the most about AI is by listening to the people leading these research firms. And Sam is certainly no different. And I think it's important that people understand not only what they're trying to build, like follow the technological aspects of it, but you have to understand the human aspects of this. And this was a a pretty raw interview with Sam, I would say. Like, it started right off the first like 10 minutes with his firing. And you can tell that there are significant scars for Sam mentally. He used the phrase shockingly painful multiple times to explain what happened. And the thing I found kind of sad is he mentioned, I don't know if you caught this, Mike, but like, he mentioned how he was a very trusting person and that this sort of like changed him. Like, his default used to be just to trust everyone. And you can tell that that is just not the case. So, you know, I think moving forward, just to understand his personal mental state, his personal desires, he mentioned at one point, I mean, I almost had to like do a double take on this one. He said it in passing and Lex almost like glossed over and then came back to it. But he's like, yeah, I might get shot at some point, basically. That was so weird. Like, but you understood what he was saying. Like, he was talking about the significance of what they're doing and how there are a lot of people who don't like necessarily what OpenAI is doing, and they see him as sort of the figurehead of it. And so he was basically saying, like, yeah, I don't know, man. Like, my life is just bizarre. So I thought it was just interesting from a personal perspective. Anyone who's listened to this show knows Ilya Sutskever. We talked about Ilya a lot, one of the, you know, prominent figures in modern AI, and was on the board at the time Sam was fired. And so, you know, to Lex, to his credit, asked all the hard questions. And he said, you know, what's going on with Ilya? And Sam said he doesn't know what his plans are. You'd have to ask him, but he hopes that they get to work together for the rest of their career. He asked specifically, what did Ilya see? And Sam said, Ilya did not see AGI. None of us have seen AGI. And there was a lot more about Ilya. So that was one of the main characters in the interview. The other one that was very prominent was Elon Musk. And again, on the personal side, you can tell Sam is just disappointed in how this has played out. Like, Elon is someone that Sam has looked up to his whole career. He sees him as a very important person in human history, and he just doesn't understand. His literal quote was, it makes me sad. Like Lex said, so the podcast, Elon chose to leave. Okay, so he asked Lex, who is friends with Elon, asked Sam about, you know, the whole lawsuit and why it happened. And Altman confirmed exactly what we said on the podcast, which was that Elon chose to leave OpenAI due to his own desires for AGI, and that he wanted to merge OpenAI with Tesla, which is exactly what we had, you know, cited from the New York Times article. And then Sam said, like, it just makes me sad. I miss the old Elon. And then it, later on in the interview, toward the end, he said, the amazing stuff about Elon is amazing, and I super respect him. I think we need him. All of us should be rooting for him and need him to step up as a leader through this next phase. So, I don't know. I found that kind of fascinating. A couple of the other ones that jumped out to me, and then Mike, I'd be interested to see if there's any other ones that caught your attention. He did ask about fair use and copyright, which we talked about last week on the show with Mira, the CTO, and Sora in particular. Lex said, do you think training AI should be or is fair use under copyright law? And Sam completely dodged it. He said, I think the question behind that question is, do people create valuable who create valuable data deserve to have some way that they get compensated for it? And that, I think the answer is yes. And he kind of says it's sort of hard. And then Lex specifically asks about Sora and says, but artists and creators are worried when they see Sora, they're like, holy shit. And Sam said, sure, artists were also super worried about photography when it came out. And then photography became a new art form and people made a lot of money taking pictures. I think things that will like that will keep happening. People will use the new tools in new ways. On AI and jobs, sort of on that path, obviously the last two episodes of this podcast, we've talked a lot about Sam's quote about 95% of what creatives do, you know. And so Lex asked him about jobs. I know that it was an interesting answer, and it does align with what he's said previously. He said, people talk about how many jobs is AI going to do in 5 years. The framework that people have is what percentage of current jobs are going to be totally replaced by some AI doing the job. The way I think about it is not what percent of jobs AI will do, but what percent of tasks will AI do over a time horizon. So he kind of like talked more about the task level, and then that sort of spun into the Sora conversation. And the one that like I was fascinated about here is Lex asked him about this idea of like, is Sora actually representing the physical world in some way? Is it understanding the physical world? And so he asked, like, you know, about its ability to represent and understand like the 3D model of the world, and asked whether or not like the current path OpenAI is taking could get to the point where it does seem to really do that. And I thought Sam, you know, he was very thoughtful in his response, but he said, I think this approach is going to go surprisingly far. So again, like we've talked many times, not all the leading AI researchers agree with each other. Like Jan LeCun would not agree with this. Like he does not think this is the path, but Sam seems fairly confident. GPT-4, I think you had made a note of this one, Mike. Lex said, for me, looking back, GPT-4, ChatGPT is pretty damn impressive, historically impressive. And Sam said, I think it kind of sucks. So, I think the key there is Sam is looking 3 to 5 years out on what he is fairly confident will be happening. And then he looks at the current stuff and says, this is obsolete. Like what we have, yeah, sure, okay, you might be impressed by it, but we won't be in time. And then that led to the GPT-5 conversation, which Sam was like, I don't even know what we're going to call it. But Lex, like, we'll call it GPT-5 just for this. Like, when's it coming out? And Sam said, you know, we're not like given a timeline, but I think we had talked previously. I was episode 87, Mike, the timeline, yeah, like May to July, which seems viable. But then he talked about how they're going to be releasing a lot of things in the process. Like, there's going to be pieces they're going to kind of release that won't be necessarily GPT-5, but kind of build up to it. That led to the Q-Star conversation. So if people have followed along on the podcast again since last November, when Sam got fired, there was this belief that they had had this scientific breakthrough they were calling Q-Star. So episode 74 from November 28th is when we talked about that in detail. But this I thought was maybe the most interesting part of the whole interview, because Lex said, this does make me think about the mysterious lore behind Q-Star. What's this Q-Star project? And then a few things about nuclear facilities, secret nuclear facilities, and some jokes kind of happen. And then Lex comes back and says, can you speak what Q-Star is? And Sam very abruptly said, we are not ready to talk about that. And Lex kind of pushed him a little bit. He said, yeah, but that's an answer. But an answer like that means there's something to talk about. It's very mysterious, Sam. And Sam said, I mean, we work on all kinds of research. We have said for a while that we think better reasoning in these systems is an important direction that we'd like to pursue. We haven't cracked the code yet. We're very interested in it. And that leads to what Q-Star is believed to be is some ability for it to do mathematics in new ways that enhances its reasoning. So now, why is reasoning important? Like, why does that matter? So reasoning is basically like the cognitive process of thinking, of our ability to think in a logical way, form a conclusion, form a judgment. So reasoning is fundamental to our human intelligence. It lets us analyze situations, figure out new information, apply knowledge under different contexts. So if you look at all the things it enables, like in the scientific process, our ability to form a hypothesis about something is because of reasoning. Our problem solving, our ability to reflect on our past experiences and thoughts, like all of that is reasoning. And that is fundamental to system two thinking, which is like the slow thinking. We're going to talk more about that throughout today's episode. This idea of giving these models time to think and analyze and reflect. And so I think that's really critical. So I thought language models and search was interesting. Regulatory capture conversation was interesting. Mm. Are there any other ones that jumped out to you, Mike, that I didn't touch on already? Again, that Gemini 1.5
is instead of the million that we have that already seems crazy. So very far-flung speculation, but I think it's worth taking seriously that it's not on that big a timeline. So we're talking like 5 to 10 years, right, Max?
Yeah, and I think he has a very, very strong history of being directionally correct in what he think the world will look like and the timelines that'll happen. Like the quote I often lead my keynotes off with is from his Moore's Law for Everything blog post from March of 2021, in which he says the coming age will focus on our most impressive, our human abilities to think, to reason, to understand language. And people didn't listen at that time. So March of 2021, he gave us a year and a half head start for when they released ChatGPT, and most business leaders weren't paying attention. And I think this is a similar moment. Like, they're telling you GPT-4 will not look impressive in retrospect. It will not seem like a significant thing. And keep in mind, they didn't release GPT-2 in 2021 because of concerns of misuse and all the things that could go wrong. So back in 2021, GPT-2 was so advanced for society that they didn't release it right away. And he's already saying GPT-4, which most people are still trying to understand and apply to their business, that it will feel equally as obsolete. He said, you know, I think the leap from 4 to 5 will feel similar to 3 to 4, where it was like, holy cow, to us, the outsiders, it was mind blowing. He is thinking that that will be the case, that we will see 5 and think, wow, we had no idea it was going to be capable of these things.
And kind of the last point that you hit on perfectly, but I just think is just so weird and just has my spidey sense tingling. It's just like, there are memes going around that have Ilya on the side of a milk carton. Like, where is he in all of this? Like, the Q-Star stuff, which was highly related to your point, to what you said.
He was one of the creators of it, supposedly.
It's very easy, obviously, to fall into conspiracy theories, which I'm not going to get into. But it is so fascinating, that human element of there is something really important about whatever went down there. And the silence is deafening, I would say.
I agree. I as we said back in November, there's something still much more to this story. And I do think that as they start releasing things throughout this year, we will start to understand a little bit more. But I do think that this system two thinking, the reasoning, and there's some other topics we'll cover today that sort of further validate that this is likely going to be very important context to have. So again, I think as a listener to this show, if you listen regularly, you're going to hear some recurring themes. And back in 2022, I interviewed Vedant Mishra at Macon. I've mentioned Vedant recently, and he's working on reasoning at DeepMind. And back in 2022, when I interviewed him, he was talking about the coming advancements in reasoning capabilities and what that would unlock for these models. So there, I mean, many of the smartest AI researchers in the world are working on variations of whatever Q-Star is and whatever kind of these advancements are. It was even a hot topic this week with Andrew Ng, Jan LeCun, other people from the FAIR Research Lab. It's directionally correct. Whatever happens next is going to be in things similar to this.
All right. So in our second big topic this week, the famed venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz just published some new research that suggests we're, quote, at an inflection point when it comes to generative AI in the enterprise. They say that while generative AI took the consumer landscape by storm in 2023, it actually reached over $1 billion of consumer spend in record time. In 2024, the revenue opportunity will be multiples larger in the enterprise. So in this research, A16Z, which is kind of their nickname, I'll refer to them as that, spoke with dozens of Fortune 500 and top enterprise leaders and then surveyed 70 more of them to understand how they're using, buying, and budgeting for Gen AI. They said, quote, "We were shocked by how significantly the resourcing and attitudes towards Gen AI had changed over the last 6 months." So it turns out that these enterprise leaders, at least the ones they talked to, despite still having reservations about Gen AI deployment, are overall planning to triple their budgets with Gen AI. Now, this full rundown is really well worth reading, but a couple highlights, Paul, jumped out at me. They said that nearly every single enterprise we spoke with saw promising early results of Gen AI experiments and plan to increase their spend anywhere from 2x to 5x in 2024 to support deploying more workloads to production. This budget also appears to be shifting from innovation budgets to more permanent software line items. They also said that enterprise leaders are currently mostly measuring ROI by increased productivity generated by AI. Most of them currently do not have the in-house technical talent to implement and scale Gen AI. They're spending a ton on implementation, and foundation model providers are kind of filling that gap by providing professional services. And then when it comes to which model and model providers people are going with, if I'm interpreting their chart correctly, 100% of the people they surveyed are either testing OpenAI's models or have them in production. 66% say they have them in production, 34% are testing. The next most popular models being used come from Google, which 63% are either testing or have in production. Llama is the third highest one. They have 6 total. Anthropic is 4th. And then Mistral and Cohere are way, way at the back of the pack. So it sounds like also based on this research, enterprises are overwhelmingly focused on building in-house right now versus buying. And they're still quite cautious about external facing use cases, given issues they're trying to overcome with hallucinations and PR possible disasters, which makes sense. The most popular use cases that these people reported were either focused on internal productivity right now or stuff that gets routed through a human, which marketing falls into, stuff that a human marketer or business person is taking a look at, making sure it's ready for prime time. So I'll stop there. Paul, you have tons of on-the-ground insight into enterprises in the work you're doing with them, your talks, your conversations you're having basically daily with enterprise leaders. Like, how accurate do you find A16Z's assessment here?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I mean, I really like these reports that are just quick hitting. Like, they there's like 16, I think, findings and just like a paragraph or two about each, like a quick read. I definitely recommend people go check out the full thing. The budget numbers really jumped out to me. I mean, those are not insignificant numbers that they were throwing around. An increase of 2 to 5x, tripling of budgets. Like, that's wild. But it makes sense as you move from the innovation budget to the operations budget, basically, that this would happen. So I wouldn't say I've heard these kinds of numbers being thrown around, that those were a bit eye-opening. But everything else they said definitely jives with what we're hearing. I would imagine they talked to a lot of tech companies, but you know, when we talk to Fortune 500 companies, sit down with their leaders, like, these are similar things we're hearing. You know, it's that the obvious ROI play is efficiency and productivity, but people want to kind of get beyond that and figure out ways to do it. And what we always advise companies is you have to benchmark performance now, and then you have to have KPIs that you will measure to determine if what you're doing is working. So whether this is a pilot project with a large language model, you know, if you're just applying it to email writing or article writing or video script writing or podcasting, whatever it is, like, whatever you're applying it to, know how you're going to measure the existing performance and then how you're going to measure against it and what success looks like. I thought the multi-model future definitely jives with what we're hearing.
Yeah.
So they're all testing a collection of models and may actually scale with a collection of models, because some are, and we'll talk a little bit about this with your experience with Claude in a minute, some are just better at others than at certain use cases. So, like, we have ChatGPT, we have Claude, we have Gemini internally. And I don't know that I would bet on any one of them. Like, sometimes the other one is just better at a certain use case. And if that use case is critical to us, I don't want to lock us in to say, hey, Mike, sorry, you have to use ChatGPT because I'm not going to pay the other $20 a month for you to have a Claude subscription. It's like, no.
Right.
Like, we're going to, with the amount of value you can create with that $20 is massive. The other thing that people want to avoid getting locked in, and then they want to quickly tap into advancements. And I hear this all the time. Like, we don't want to lock into a 12-month agreement with this company, because what happens if GPT-5 comes out and it obsoletes that company? And we're going to hear some examples of that in a couple minutes. The other one is desire for control stems from sensitive use cases and enterprise data security concerns. Hear that all the time. I spent a bunch of time with a big law firm recently, and this was like 1A. It was the number one thing they were asking about was, How do we protect our data and our clients' data? Which of these models can we actually trust with that kind of stuff? And then the other one I thought that definitely makes a ton of sense is cloud service provider-driven decisions. If you're already in, and again, big enterprises all the time get this. If you already are a Microsoft customer, you're going to likely use Azure. If you're a Google Cloud customer, you're going to use some model through Google, probably Gemini. And then if you're AWS, you're probably going to go with Anthropic, Amazon's own models, or Cohere or something like that. So in a big company where you already have a trusted provider who already has access to all of your data, you are way more likely to trust them to infuse this stuff in, and you don't have to get them through procurement again. That's the challenge we're seeing with a lot of these kind of more startup models in the Gen AI space, the companies in that space. Is getting through procurement is really hard, especially if they want access to your data. So overall, again, a quick read, it's probably like a 7-minute read. definitely aligns with what we're seeing and hearing in the marketplace.
So I found the chart really interesting where they talked about this specific models from specific companies that enterprises are using. So like OpenAI and Google, according to the chart, which you can go look at, are basically ahead by a mile. And the open source move is like pretty clearly Llama. Are we moving towards a reality in the enterprise where even if they are using multiple models, it's like a very small number of them?
I would assume so. Like, I think it's going to be like the cloud space. You know, it's like AWS, Google Cloud, and Microsoft Azure. That's pretty much it. Yeah. And I could see language models largely falling into that realm where there's three major players. One of them, OpenAI / Microsoft, probably is dominant unless Google Gemini really powers ahead, which, you know, certainly possible. And then you've got, you know, Anthropic out there, which obviously they're getting a lot of love for their updated Claude models. But I think it seems very viable. And again, we're going to talk about a couple other topics today that sort of point in the direction of there's going to be a small collection of dominant players, and then there's going to be some other players.
So some final thoughts here. I just had a question on kind of, do you have any take on what this might mean for like enterprise-focused startups, not these big companies, the ones trying to break into enterprises with AI solutions?
I mean, each of the points sort of stack against those startups. And, yeah, you know, I think it's indicating it's going to be a lot harder for these companies that are trying to build their own models or that are, you know, wrappers for the existing models. I think it's just it's a continually steepening uphill battle to compete with companies that can spend billions building these models and acquiring the talent. And yeah, I think the next main topic, we're going to see this played out. Like, even the ones who are raising billions still have uphill battles. So yeah, I think it's a challenging landscape for the companies that don't have tens of thousands of NVIDIA chips and can pay $1 million bonuses to get the top AI researchers to switch over to their company. It's a very, very competitive environment right now. And you got some of that even listening to Sam talk. Like, they asked about the competition, and it's just wildly competitive for the customers, for the talent, for the compute power, for the data.
Yeah.
And if you don't have the data, then it becomes even harder, which is, again, we've always said it's what Google has. They got lots and lots of proprietary tools and proprietary data. OpenAI has it sort of through Microsoft, through their partnership with Microsoft, but didn't inherently have their own proprietary data to start with. It's where Amazon has, you know, potentially a say in this, and it's where XAI / Twitter / X / Grok / Elon, like, they have the X Twitter feed that other people don't. Meta, certainly a player. Like, it's really hard to compete with the companies that have the money and the resources to do the compute and get the people, and they have proprietary data.
Yeah.
If you don't have the proprietary data and you have the money, it may not matter.
All right. So we're kind of seeing, to your point, this playing out a little bit in our third big topic this week. We've got some major AI news that I'm sure we'll be hearing more about in coming weeks. Mustafa Suleiman, the co-founder and CEO of Inflection AI and a former co-founder of Google DeepMind, is leaving Inflection to start Microsoft AI, which is a new division at Microsoft that will bring together their consumer AI efforts as well as Copilot, Bing, and Edge. As part of this move, Microsoft has also hired most of Inflection's staff. Inflection as a company says it will continue with a new CEO, but it will not have its founder and much of its talent. Now, the company said in a blog post that its plan moving forward is to, quote, lean into our AI studio business, where custom generative AI models are crafted, tested, and fine-tuned for commercial customers. Now, this is a huge deal, and I want to, as we unpack this, it's kind of helpful to remember some of the context here. Inflection is a giant in AI. It had raised $1.5 billion from investors, and those investors included Microsoft. their main consumer-facing product was Pi, which they billed as the first emotionally intelligent AI assistant. So they're trying to essentially compete in a consumer context with the open AIs of the world. Also relevant here is that Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn fame was a co-founder of Inflection and sits on Microsoft's board. So Paul, there is a lot to unpack here, but let's start with what does this kind of mean in context and what does this mean for the overall AI ecosystem?
Yeah, it's ironic because we just talked about Pi last week and I think it was last week or the week before. I was sharing, like I was actually kind of enjoying the new model. I'd only play with it the one time, but it was, you know, pretty cool. I think it, like, as to build on the previous topic, it is a tale of caution, for sure, as a user, as a company or an individual, personally, professionally. If you were enjoying Pi and it had become like a daily tool for you, whether it was a, you know, coach, advisor, therapist, friend, mentor, whatever, however you were using Pi, what happens now? Like, are they going to at some point realize this studio thing is just like, it's just PR and this is not going to work and Microsoft just eventually absorbs them? Is there some deal where they get the data in this non-acquisition? I mean, in essence, it's an acquisition without actually buying the company.
Right.
So if, let's say you've been having, experimenting with Pi for the last 6 months as a friend, like just talking to it, seeing how it works. Does Microsoft get that data? Like, what happens to all that personal information you were talking to Pi about? And so again, I'm not saying Pi in particular, I'm saying like, this is what happens. Like, we come to trust these AI tools, these AI companies, but what happens to the data? What happens when the company goes away and you don't have that tool, or they do just get acquired and they just shut down and sunset the product? So I think, again, it's just a bit of a cautionary tale of, this is a very dynamic space we're living through and it's just starting. Couple of other things that I found interesting was, building on the previous topic, further evidence that we will likely end up having a small collection of dominant companies, dominant models. They had, as you said, $1.5 billion, and they raised that like in the last 12 months.
Yeah.
And it's just gone, basically. One interesting note was they are rumored to have 22,000 NVIDIA GPUs. The going rate for those GPUs is, give or take, around $30,000 per GPU. 30,000 times 22,000 GPUs is 660 million. There's an article in The Information yesterday that said in this exchange, Microsoft was paying 650 million to Inflection. Kind of real close numbers that maybe Microsoft basically is just getting the talent and the GPUs from NVIDIA in exchange for whatever. So yeah. And then, like you said, there's just so much intrigue here. There's a potential conflict with OpenAI. I mean, they're competitors and Microsoft's the biggest investor in OpenAI. So what happens there? Microsoft now has a Microsoft AI division, which I thought they previously had, but apparently they didn't. So now they have one and Mustafa is the CEO of it, which is a shakeup to all the other AI talent at Microsoft, I would assume. So there's that whole thing. And then the one that I just immediately thought of when I saw this was, isn't this what Sam and Greg were going to go do? So when Sam got fired that weekend, it was like, what, a Thursday or Friday? By Saturday night, Satya Nadella said, Sam and Greg are going to come work with us. We're going to take, you know, their team, and we're going to build an AI division with Sam and Greg at the core of it. So in essence, Satya got the consolation prize. Like, oh, okay, Sam went back to OpenAI. All right, fine, we'll take Mustafa and we'll build a division around him. So I don't know, man. It's so fascinating. This stuff is like a soap opera. I know people comment all the time about the podcast. It's like, in essence, reporting on these soap operas. And this is definitely one of them. And I'm sure there's way more to this story than has currently been reported.
Well, as you noted too, it's a pretty interesting and potentially repeatable playbook where someone, instead of having to acquire the full company, is essentially getting all the parts of the machine and leaving the shell of it behind, right?
Yep.
So as part of all this commentary around it, a guy named Gavin Baker, who's a really sharp AI commentator at Atreides Capital, he posted a thread on X about the long-term implications of this. And he started it out by saying, quote, Inflection will likely be the first of many VC-backed foundation model companies to fail. Foundation models without proprietary real-time data and massive distribution for reinforcement learning with human feedback, RLHF, are the fastest depreciating assets in history. I think we have discussed some of his commentary before on this subject. Do you find any truth in that?
Yeah, I mean, it's what we just said on the previous topic. Like, if you don't have data and all you have is a model and computing power and some talent,
yeah,
and some VC money, it's only going to get so far unless you find some massive differentiator, some market that no one else is in. Like, I don't know what it is. I haven't sat down and thought deeply enough about it, but yeah, it's a very challenging environment to invest. Like, as someone who does some angel investing, some personal investing, like, I would have a real hard time making personal bets on model companies right now. It's just such a unknown, and it's really, really hard to bet against the big players that they aren't going to just dominate everything. So yeah, I would have a hard time disputing what Gavin's saying there.
All right. So in our rapid fire topics today, the hits keep on coming because
tough week for Gen AI companies.
Stability AI, which is a leading AI image generation company. They're the ones behind commercializing the Stable Diffusion image generation model. They appear to be having some serious issues. Now, we just learned that three of the five original researchers, three of the five people who are integral to the company's founding technology, they have just resigned. And this is not the first set of high-profile departures. Over the last year or so, Stability AI has lost a number of product research and engineering executives. One of these was someone we talked about at the time named Ed Newton Rex, who resigned in November of 2023 to basically just protest the fact that he thought the company was training its models on copyrighted data. This is also not the only drama to engulf the company. Bloomberg has reported that at one point, the company was burning $8 million a month and did not appear anywhere near any type of break-even point. The investment firm Coatue that was leading the round resigned from the board at one point, and Stability recently sold off ClipDrop, an image generation platform, to Jasper in February. At one point, Forbes also reported that Stability had struggled to pay wages and taxes. Now, this is a pretty dramatic reversal because just 18 months ago, Stability had raised money at a $1 billion valuation. And plenty of people at the time would have considered Stable Diffusion, the model at least, as one of the heavyweight kind of players in this space. So now it sounds like we're talking, Paul, about a company that seems to be in extremely bad shape. Like, what's going on here? What kind of lessons might we be able to take from this?
Yeah. So again, if you're a regular listener to the show, you might have noticed we don't talk much about Stability AI. And in some ways, it's a bit, we try and be super objective on this show. I'm not a fan of the company. Like, I've really struggled to think that they were a legitimate company. And the reason is the founding story is very bizarre. So Ahmad was, they basically provided computing power to, like, these, I think it was five researchers who were developing the Stable Diffusion model.
Yeah.
And in their fundraising process, Ahmad basically took credit for inventing this Stable Diffusion, which was a key breakthrough kind of in the development of image generation and things like that. So the company has all kinds of, it just doesn't smell right. I guess is one way to say it. Like, the instinct I have around this company is there's just so many stories about how it was built and how it's been run, and I generally just kind of pay attention to what they're doing, but I don't put a bunch of stock in it. So I think part of this might be representative. Just, it's, as we talk about, it's a very challenging world to build a Gen AI company in, that's building and maintaining these big models. This one could very well also just be, it was a company meant from the start to not make it. And again, it's just, I don't know them personally. I've never interviewed them or anything like that. But when you start seeing all of these stories stacking up, you know, over your career, you just, people, we all kind of like learn to assess a situation. I've personally just always assessed that this was a company that likely wasn't going to maintain being a major player because things just didn't add up. So cool tech, but company wise, just I haven't always been very impressed with them.
Right. So we're also seeing another leading company facing some headwinds too. Cohere, which is a major AI company backed by Jeff Hinton, who's a very notable, some would say maybe even the godfather of modern AI. Yeah. And co-founded by Aidan Gomez, who is a major AI researcher. They're running into some issues according to reporting from The Information. According to that reporting, Cohere was generating just $13 million in annualized revenue at the end of 2023. Now, that is not a lot for a company valued like Cohere is. The company has raised more than $400 million. They're reportedly trying to raise another $500 million. Late last year, their fundraising that they were engaging in was looking to value the firm at $6 billion, which would be a crazy valuation given this annualized revenue. It's more than 450 times this annualized revenue, which is also a way higher multiple than even OpenAI, which makes a ton of money apparently. Now, according to The Information, Cohere has kind of tried to now differentiate itself from larger competitors by starting to sell to only enterprises. And in recent months, company leaders have decided not to compete with the big players by developing frontier models. Someone with direct knowledge of this decision told The Information this. Instead, the company is now focused on retrieval augmented generation, RAG technology, which helps reduce AI's hallucinations and increases its accuracy. Now, this is not saying, you know, Cohere is out of money totally or falling apart necessarily, but that's extremely low revenue for a company that is looking to do what Cohere is doing. And Paul, I still remember you messaging me when Cohere was first announced. I mean, it's super significant in terms of the people backing it, the people who founded it. These are legit AI leaders who are running this company. You've been watching since literally day one. What can you tell us about Cohere's current troubles and future prospects?
So this one is different than Stability AI. This is a company I have spent some time with does not have the same challenges of running a company that I would say Stability has. It seems like a really strong team. I think this is more representative of the other things we've talked about, of just the challenges of competing in this space.
Yeah.
And the uncertainty about what will win. So like this move to betting on retrieval augmented generation or RAG makes a lot of sense in the current state of things. But just in the last like 5 days, I've seen so much context in tweets from like industry leaders about how these bigger models just outperform everything. And especially when they're given time to think, the system two thinking we talked about. There was the one example, and we'll get to this a little bit with the Claude example, where was it Malik that shared it? Where if you give GPT 3.5 time to think, basically, that it actually outperforms GPT-4. And so in essence, like, it seems like we're not even fully comprehending what these bigger models are capable of.
Yeah.
And those bigger models are only getting bigger and smarter. And so the question for all of these companies becomes, when we have GPT-5, even GPT-6 class models, Gemini 2, Gemini 3 class models, Claude 4 class models, does it even matter anymore to do RAG? Like, is that even necessary? Or is the context window so massive and it just remembers everything and like doesn't forget and it doesn't hallucinate? Like, do we solve all these inefficiencies? And so is there really a market long term for these companies that are basically trying to find the weakness in the current models and solve for it if that weakness doesn't exist in 12 months? And that's where I said, like, I don't know. Like, I am not the expert. I've never built a model like this. Like, I'm not the inside person working on these things every day. We're just consuming and synthesizing a whole bunch of information and trying to connect the dots. And the dots seem to be leading to, like, anything you think is a weakness today probably won't be in 12 months, or it'll be largely solved. And so I think that's the challenge of the environment, is like, how do you build and scale an AI tech company in this environment where 12 months from now, what's true today won't be true anymore?
Well, the good news is it's not all bad news for major AI companies. In a more positive development, Anthropic just announced a partnership with AWS and the consulting firm Accenture to build AI solutions for the enterprise. According to an Anthropic announcement, over 1,400 Accenture engineers will be trained as specialists in using Anthropic's models on AWS, allowing them to provide customers with end-to-end support that accelerates their AI strategies from concept to production. So basically, they are teaming up to be able to provide Anthropic models running on AWS to Accenture's customers, which seems to plug in a couple of those gaps that we talked about in the A16Z research, which is interesting. Now, also, according to the reporting from the information we just talked about in reference to Cohere, they also mentioned that Anthropic appears to be doing okay when it comes to revenue. The company has projected it's going to generate more than $850 million in annualized revenue by the end of 2024. Now, you can take that estimate with a grain of salt if you want, but it sounds a lot better than $13 million per year. Now, Paul, we're going to talk in a little bit more about Anthropic's flagship model, Claude 3 Opus, but how do you evaluate their place in the overall AI race right now?
They're a major player. And again, if you're not familiar with them, new to the podcast, new to the space, in 2021, 10% of OpenAI's staff left to create Anthropic. And the premise was to put safety first, that they felt OpenAI was no longer pursuing safe AI and at the level they would like to see it done. So Dario Amodei and a few other people left OpenAI to do it. The interesting complexity to all of this is, like, how is this achieving that mission? So if they're racing ahead and Claude 3 is truly like GPT-4 class model, and they're just building the most powerful models in the world, how are they becoming any different from or their original mission of, like, the safety first? And I've listened to plenty of interviews with Dario that they need to build these bigger models so they can build the safety in, but maybe we'll make a few billion a year in the process of, like, I don't know. Like, I've always found Anthropic to be a bit of a confusing company, that they have this stated mission, and I don't know if I don't know how they justify becoming one of the major players and building this massive enterprise revenue model and still pursue the original mission. Maybe there's some way to do it. I don't know. But all that being said, this does definitely fit with the A16Z thing. And I think it also, you know, along the lines of how does Cohere, you know, make it, how, you know, Inflection was trying to make it. In this case, this is a distribution play. So what Anthropic did is they aligned themselves with Accenture that has the distribution of thousands of enterprise clients. And so now you immediately have your model baked into there. And then it aligns with the cloud service provider choice of, if you're on AWS and you already trust them with all your data, you can build right on top of Claude 3 with your data already living in AWS. So it definitely makes sense. And again, I think if you zoom out from this episode, you can really start to see the trend lines for how adoption is going to work with these models and some of the roadblocks that the model companies are going to have.
All right, we're going to talk a little bit more about Anthropic and Claude 3 Opus, their flagship model. We're going to kick off this discussion, Paul, by talking about a LinkedIn post that you recently put up about a prompt library that Anthropic released, where they have collected a ton of really useful business and personal prompts for users to employ using Claude or anything else, frankly. It seems like it got a lot of attention. Do you want to maybe talk about how that came about and what you found valuable about it?
Yeah, I think it's, I actually got their email last week, Anthropic's email announcing, like, different things at Claude 3, and they had this prompt library in there. So I was just kind of checking it out. It did get a lot of attention on LinkedIn, but I think it's because it's so practical. I do think a lot of people still just struggle with prompting. Like it's weird. It's that blank page syndrome. You're staring at the put your prompt in thing. It's like, what do I say? How do I tell it? And so I think it's very helpful for people just to see these prompts. So yeah, again, we'll put the link in the show notes. OpenAI has a similar one where they give prompt examples, but in this case, it gives like the system prompt, the user prompt, and a sample output. And there's some fun ones in there. There's like play prompts, they call them. There's work prompts. And so I highlighted a few. There was like a meeting scribe, a grammar genie, a lesson planner, an interview question crafter. And I think the key is like just to look at how these prompts are structured. So Anthropic is telling you, this is the best way to prompt our system. This is what the prompt should look like. But what we know is these models, oddly enough, function all in a very similar way. And so if a prompt works well on Claude, it's likely going to work well on Gemini and ChatGPT. So that was the thing for me is I just thought it was kind of cool. I've seen a ton of positive feedback on Claude 3. I've only been able to test it a few times through Perplexity. So if you're a Perplexity page user, you can go in your preferences and choose which model to use. So they have their own model. They have Claude. They have GPT-4, and I forget the others. There's like five different models you can choose from. So I've experimented with Claude recently, Claude Opus, through Perplexity. But I know, Mike, you've spent some more time playing around with it. So like, what has your experience been with Claude 3 Opus?
Yeah, so to kind of tee this up, the Claude 3 family of models came out like the beginning of March. Like these are maybe 3 weeks old, I think. And they pretty quickly, not changed the game is probably the wrong phrase, but they have really opened people's eyes because there's three models. They're all just varying levels of power and speed. So there's Claude 3 Haiku, which is the fastest and weakest, middle of the road Claude 3 Sonnet, and the most intelligent and slowest. And that really kind of more comes into play when you're building on top of it, right? Not when you're using it necessarily as a user. It's not really that noticeable. Claude 3 Opus, and that's the one I've been playing around with. You get access to that in the paid, like Claude Pro version you can buy.
Is that $20 a month? Is that their
it's
model?
$20 bucks a month. Really, yeah. Yeah. So it's very similar to ChatGPT Plus. So what I'm doing, we give this advice to people all the time, is my approach to these tools is have dozens of core use cases and prompts that I'm continually refining that I'm then testing across major tools, because this is exactly what we've kind of advised people is sometimes a model comes along that makes more use cases possible or changes the game a little bit. And this is one of them.
Because, which fits into that multi-model approach we talked with A16Z. It's like, don't log into a single, like you always got to be testing.
100%. And I have started testing, especially my content generation and writing related prompts with Claude 3, and it has blown me away. It is crazy good at writing. It is really, really good at mimicking style. And some of that has also been on my end, testing more extensive prompts along the style that Anthropic has recommended, a system prompt to prime the tool to get ready to do what I want it to do. And then a user prompt, and in my case, they're starting to get to be pages long because I want to provide examples, context, things like that. So it actually does what I want it to do at a really, really high quality level. And like the writing results I've gotten from Claude 3 have been really, really impressive to the point where I would probably default to it for like a basic writing task. And this is, again, not like we're putting out blog posts that Claude 3 is writing, but stuff like summarizing, interpreting transcripts, turning those into like first drafts that I can really use to polish up and to get ideas from and riff on, headlines, stuff like that. It's incredible. I've just been really, really impressed. This is actually a thing I did a pretty big deep dive into in my first ever generative AI mastery session. So this is part of our AI mastery membership that we actually started offering, which is a yearly membership with a number of different benefits each month for people who really want to continue down that journey of AI mastery on an ongoing basis. And one of the deep dives I did where I demonstrate actual technology with actual prompts was Claude 3. We spent a huge amount of time on it in that session, which I think actually dropped
a couple hours ago.
Yeah, it came out Friday the 22nd.
So if that is of interest, that's well worth checking out that membership. But regardless, absolutely you need to be checking out Claude 3. And I think especially if you're not using any of the paid versions of these models, you're going to be blown away.
Yeah, it's one of those I want to get in and spend more time with it. That and Gemini, which we're going to talk about in a minute.
Yeah.
So the AI Mastery membership Mike mentioned, you go to marketingacademy.ai. It'll take you right to that information. This is a new thing that we did launch at the end of January or into February, I think.
Yeah.
And so we do, in addition to all the other things that we offer for free, this is a paid program. But Mike and I do a quarterly AI trends briefing. The Gen AI Mastery series is a quarterly thing that Mike does. And then we do a quarterly Ask Me Anything session with me in addition to a host of other benefits. So yeah, if you're interested in the Mastery membership, it is, again, marketingacademy.ai.
So yeah, I would say in terms of a model you absolutely have to check out and continue trying to cycle through, couldn't recommend right now Claude 3 Opus enough. So definitely give that a whirl. On the theme of things that are just blowing my mind here, Google has now granted everyone access to Gemini 1.5, which is its latest, most powerful model. So they have a sandbox environment through their AI studio. We will put the link in the show notes.
It's just aistudio.google.com, right?
I believe so, yeah.
I'll check it while you're talking.
Yeah, well. So this is not even just Gemini Advanced, which we have a paid subscription to, which is Gemini 1.0, which is a super powerful new model that Google released. This is the next version. This is also making a ton of waves because it has a 1 million token context window. So in addition to just being a far more advanced model in terms of reasoning, Gemini 1.5 Pro can, according to Google, process vast amounts of information in one go. That includes things like 1 hour of video, 11 hours of audio, code bases with over 30,000 lines of code, or over 700,000 words. So since anyone can access Gemini 1.5 Pro right now in this test environment, we actually went and tried it out. So for a test, we used a topic that we're probably going to be talking about next week a little more on the podcast. Right before recording, we found the White House had released its annual economic report of the president, the ERP, which is an annual report produced by the Council of Economic Advisors. It's on every topic imaginable, and one chapter this year was about AI. Now, the problem is this report is literally almost 500 pages
long. That chapter alone is like 50 pages.
And it is not easy to read writing, let me tell you. Shout out to all the very smart people in the U.S. government, but it is very academic, let's say that. But we actually just dropped the entire report into Gemini 1.5 Pro and just asked it to summarize the AI chapter. Now, it'll actually tell you when you upload a file how many tokens it is. And this was, the entire report was 675,000 tokens. So we didn't even hit the full 1 million token limit. Gemini appears to have done a pretty good job. I went through and kind of spot checked and asked a couple questions, opened up the actual report, started reading it a bit. The summary was, in my experience, perfect. Like, it was on point. I checked the themes it talked about. It referenced specific language and frameworks that the government was advising. So I went and tried to hunt those down, make sure it wasn't making those up. Those were accurate. I asked where did the government get the data from? Because it referenced at one time the government used a bunch of data sets. So it listed those out. I didn't check every single one, but a spot check looked like it was accurate. In the government report, like an academic paper, they cite work by researchers and put their last names in parentheses and say like, hey, we're citing so-and-so's research from like 2018 or whatever. So I said, hey, could you give me the list of researchers cited in the AI chapter? Again, I got, probably 50 names back. I didn't check every single one, but I checked 10, 15 of them, all accurate. It was incredible. This was like looking into the future of what large context windows are. So I'll stop with that. there at that experiment, Paul, but like, you really have to take seriously that I don't know if we're going to get a million tokens in like a $20 a month Gemini Advanced account.
Think we what,
but it's going to be crazy.
Because one of
so
the lead researchers tweeted yesterday that the 10 million context is working too.
Yes.
Yeah. And like back to what we said about how hard this is, like a year, year and a half ago, Mike, I know you talked to these companies, like there was people raising funding to build PDF summarizers.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that was a company idea a year and a half ago. And now you just play around in the sandbox and you drop a 300 page PDF and it analyzes it. It is aistudio.google.com. It is more technical. It's like a sandbox for users, but you can, there's even a new tuned model. Like you can come in here and it says like, you can tune a model from an existing structured prompt or create one by importing from Google Sheets or a CSV. Tuning only works on text at this time. We recommend 100 to 500 examples. So if you want to like train a model to do something, you can come in here and do this stuff. Again, like I can't stress enough, the two things we always like say are so critical is AI literacy and competency. The competency comes from experimentation. If you don't go and like see what these things are capable for yourself, or if it's not you, like make sure someone in your company is constantly testing. These are like Mike and I push each other all the time on this stuff. Like we were having coffee this morning, I met for breakfast, and we're like going back and forth on this and like, oh, we're recording like 5 hours. Like, hey, let's drop that 300 page PDF and see what happens.
Yeah.
This is the kind of culture you have to have. Like you have to have people, whether it's your AI council or something more informal, where you're just watching what's going on and saying, man, this might be something significant. This could change the way we do X. So yeah, hopefully that's part of what this show does, is like gives you the inspiration to get out there and try stuff, because listening to us talk about it, it's only going to get you so far, but this stuff is crazy. Like it's the kind of stuff where I just noticed there's a prompt gallery in here too. Just like we were talking about with Anthropic. Yeah. You can go in here and see a whole bunch of prompts. It's the kind of thing, like I wish I had 3 hours this afternoon to actually go play around myself with these things, but it's not always the case. And so again, depending on your role in the company, you might not be the one that gets to go do these things, but create the culture that enables it, that everyone can kind of learn and share internally.
Yeah. And one last note here, and I've harped on this before, and I'm sure I will in the future, is you have to have a use case first mentality here. You need to be documenting, even if you have not tried out AI for certain use cases, I need you to like start thinking about what would I love if it were possible AI could do for me, because I can tell you for a fact, several of the things that I put through Claude 3 Opus and Gemini 1.5 were things that were aspirational, that I was not able to do before, that are now unlocked and I'm ready to go, able to demonstrate the technology and start doing more things and essentially gaining more superpowers because I prepped in advance. So it's helpful to continually do that. All right. Couple more stories here until we, before we wrap up our rapid fire. Google Chrome has also quietly rolled out a couple of AI features that may be worth experimenting with. And the biggest one is an AI-powered writing suggestion feature right within Chrome. So this feature is called Help Me Write, and it will give you AI writing suggestions when you write on the web. So once it's enabled in Chrome, you right-click on an open text field while using the Chrome browser, and then click Help Me Write. A prompt window opens up and you can prompt Chrome's AI to write or rewrite text as you need. Now, Chrome also at the same time released a way to generate your own custom Chrome visual theme using AI, which is kind of fun, but not super important. But Paul, you had flagged especially the Help Me Write feature. I think you've maybe experimented with it a little bit. What were your thoughts here?
Yeah, so it just pops up when I updated Chrome and it takes you to the What's New tab.
Yeah.
And it is just like this infusion of the Help Me Write button throughout. And then there's also what you can create an AI-based theme and stuff. And then there's like a smart organizer for tabs. We first talked about this back on episode 81, which was end of January, 2024. And at the time, what we were saying, and this is why I think this becomes so significant, is they have this massive distribution of this thing. So there's over 1 billion Chrome users, I think, or they have 63% of all internet users use Chrome.
Yeah.
And what we said at the time was this complexity of this landscape. Like, I have Cohere, I have Gemini, I have Anthropic, Claude, I have all these options, but we're more advanced users of, like, we're seeking the latest thing and we're trying to go find these tools. The vast majority of people aren't doing what we're doing. You know, yeah. If you listen to the show, you're likely in our camp. You're an early adopter. You're trying to, like, be a first mover. You're trying to figure this stuff out. The average internet user, though, the help me write button from Chrome might be the first time they actually use an AI tool, like knowingly use an AI writing tool. Mm. And so I think that's the key here is I don't know how good it's going to be, but I know it's going to make a lot of the other things you have redundant. So if I have the Chrome extension turned on and I go into LinkedIn, well, I already have a help me write button in LinkedIn. Am I just going to ignore that one, or a rewrite button in LinkedIn? Or if I'm in HubSpot and I have my AI writer, or if I'm using Jasper or Writer or Claude or, like, whatever I'm doing, this thing's just going to follow me everywhere. So if there's a form where I can write something, it's going to be there with me.
Yep.
And that starts to get into, like, you could start to see the changing of behavior. And if that is the Gemini model, like if 6 months from now we have Gemini 2, and this 1.5 model we're talking about that has a million tokens of contact, if that's the thing that's a free extension baked right into Chrome, that changes things. And so that's what I find so fascinating about this is, like, how is this going to affect everything? And I don't have the answers at all. Obviously, neither of us do, Mike, but this is, like, it's just going to be such a wild time this year. I don't know. So I'll report back if I actually, like, really start testing it. But right now I think it's going to be more of the non-advanced user who's going to start experimenting with this stuff all the time. Like, I could see my kids saying, like, oh, yeah, there's, like, help me write button popped up on my Chrome. Like, should I use it? Like, I don't know.
So our last news item really, I think, brings all of these themes today together. A new deep dive was just published from the famous tech writer Stephen Levy in Wired Magazine, detailing the behind-the-scenes story of how, in their words, quote, 8 Google employees invented modern AI. The story looks at how 8 AI researchers within Google in 2017 came to publish the research on Transformers, which is the technology that kicked off the generative AI revolution. The paper that introduced Transformers is called Attention is All You Need, and it's possibly the most famous paper in modern AI. Now, according to this article, approaching its 7th anniversary, the Attention paper has attained legendary status. The authors started with a thriving and improving technology, a variety of AI called neural networks, and made it into something else. A digital system so powerful that its output can feel like the product of an alien intelligence. Called Transformers, this architecture is the not-so-secret sauce behind all those mind-blowing AI products, including ChatGPT and graphic generators such as DALL-E and Midjourney. All 8 researchers are no longer at Google, and all of them are kind of their own type of celebrity in AI, and they include people who have gone on to found notable AI companies like Aidan Gomez, Cohere, like we just talked about. Now, this story is well worth a read. It gives an inside look at all the work, the conviction, kind of the sheer accidents that had to happen for this paper to come together and this technology to transform the world. It also prompted a response from Jan LeCun, who noted that the story leaves out other notable innovations on the way to Transformers that also clearly inspired the researchers. Now, Paul, this is another AI topic you have followed since almost day one. Can you unpack for us why a 2017 paper and the people behind it are worth paying attention to in 2024?
Yeah, I'll refer people back to episode 81. So from January 30th, 2024, I did a piece on Where Are They Now, where I actually was doing some research and I pulled the 8 people and kind of what companies they were with. And they'd collectively raised, what, $1.3 billion or $1.5 billion, yeah, or something like that. So that episode goes into, like, the full history behind this. The quick highlights, I guess. So again, I think most people listening to the show are probably aware of this, but GPT stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. That is where this name came from. So ChatGPT. These 8 people also did an interview with Jensen Huang, from the CEO of NVIDIA, this week at the GTC conference. So you can actually go watch the interview of the 8 of them together. And then, but the one thing I caught my attention, Mike, I know you highlighted this in like your notes when you're reading through it, is one of them was involved in QSTAR. So what was the part about QSTAR that came up in the article?
So the gentleman's name, his last name is Kaiser, and an excerpt, and I highlighted this because with our other topic, I was like, this seems really strange they'd mention this. So according to Stephen Levy, the journalist, Kaiser is the only one who hasn't founded a company. He joined OpenAI and is one of the inventors of a new technology called QSTAR, which Altman said last year will, quote, push the veil of ignorance back and the frontier of discovery forward. Here's the part. When I attempted to quiz Kaiser on this in our interview, the OpenAI PR person almost leaped across the table to silence him.
Oh, man. Soap opera. Like I said, it's a soap opera. So, yeah, I read the Wired article. Go listen to episode 81 where we talked about it. Just check the timestamps. You can zoom right to that part. But I think like you said, this is a great way to end it. This is kind of like the people that sort of started this evolution back in 2017, building on, as Jan said earlier, breakthroughs. So it's kind of where we started, and QSTAR might be where we're going if we have PR people leaping across the table to shut people up and Sam Altman saying we're not ready to talk about that in an angrily tone. So, oh, man. All right. Good stuff.
All right.
Yeah. Thanks for pulling it all together, Mike.
Yeah, no problem, Paul. Thanks for unpacking all this and all the connections between these stories. We really appreciate it. And until next week.
All right, everyone. Thank you. Oh, and as Michael says, check the newsletter. There's like 10 things that didn't make the cut this week, including Project Groot, which I really wanted to talk about. Maybe we'll do that next week. So that was a cool one. NVIDIA is doing this crazy stuff with robotics. We got to talk about that one next week. All right, everyone. Have a great week. We will talk to you again soon.
Thanks for listening to The AI Show. Visit marketingaiinstitute.com to continue your AI learning journey and join more than 60,000 professionals and business leaders who have subscribed to the weekly newsletter, downloaded the AI blueprints, attended virtual and in-person events, taken our online AI courses, and engaged in the Slack community. Until next time, stay curious and explore AI.